The Forgotten Soldier, Disc 7, Chapter 49. Kurt said, "Tell me what?" The Taliban and the government of Afghanistan are holding covert peace talks. Not the ones you read about in the press in Pakistan or with China overseeing. Real talks, held in secret in Oslo, Norway, without the pressure of public results or posturing on Twitter. Since the announcement of Mullah Omar's death, things have sputtered, with the Islamic State working the fractures inside the Taliban. We can't allow them a foothold. Haider al-Attiya is our go-between with the government of Qatar. Billings thinks he's crucial to the outcome because of the weight Qatar carries. Kurt said, "Seriously? Who gives a shit what Billings thinks? We're talking about a potential attack and he's kissing the ass of a terrorist? I'd exclude him from the discussion because he's no longer impartial." President Warren bristled and said, "I'll remind you he's the Secretary of State. I care what he thinks." Kurt backpedaled. "Sir, sorry. There's just something else that's been nagging, and Billings is at the heart of it." The assault on Guy in the cafe was extremely complex and involved local players. It has to be tied into what Guy was doing. But there's no way a group from Qatar would have known they were being hunted in enough time to establish such an elaborate plan. The first man in Key West is held as an unsolved murder, and the second was still warm by the time of the assault.
What are you implying?
Someone had to tell the Qataris they were being hunted. I think it's Billings.
Palmer exhaled and said, "Preposterous. He was given a direct order not to."
"Like I said to Billings at the last council meeting, I'm not making up the facts. There is no way that attack on Guy could have been planned and executed without forewarning."
President Warren rubbed his face, saying, "I don't know if it's preposterous. After his outburst, I could see him doing that, thinking he was in the right. He has a strong moral streak and a disdain for the use of force. It's why I like his voice on the council."
Palmer said, "What do you want to do about it?"
"I'll handle Billings. These talks could be the beginning of the end of combat in Afghanistan. It is crucial for them to continue."
Kurt said, "At the very least, don't let him meet with Haider by himself anymore. Make him take a CIA case officer. Someone who can judge what's going on from both sides. Billings doesn't have the experience for that."
Palmer said, "That's not a bad idea." President Warren said, "Okay, Palmer, talk to Kerry at CIA. He looked at Kurt and said, "You mourn the loss of Guy's brother, but I have to look to the future. Intercepting Haider right now may mean the death of more people down the road because these talks fail. They may not be American lives, but they deserve a chance at peace. I don't like it any more than you do, but I have a greater responsibility."
"Sir, I'm not asking for Omega, just Alpha authority. Let me explore with Pike's team. It may be a way to bring in Guy. He came looking for help, and when Pike ignored him, he went on his own. If he thinks we're on board, maybe he'll come in."
Palmer said, "Just tell him that. Tell Pike he's got Alpha, then when he pulls in Guy, call him off."
"You want me to lie to Pike? What's a lie matter when we've got this calamity on our hands? You lie on a daily basis about everything you do."
"Sir, you order me to do that, and you'll destroy the task force. We've been talking around this issue since I came in here today. We need good men like Blaine. Men we trust to do the right thing on the ground. But that's a two-way street. Guy feels like he's been betrayed, but he's mistaken. If I lie to Pike, it will be a betrayal. No matter the greater good you envision, it will be corrosive to the unit. Nobody will trust anything I say, thinking they're being played. And in our world, in a world where we do lie for the greater good, it will destroy the essence of who we are.
President Warren held up his hand, stopping the argument.
I get it. I understand completely. I'm not asking you to lie to Pike, but if you want Alpha authority, it'll have to go to the Council. Which means Billings.
Can't you cut him out? Hell, he misses half the meetings anyway.
Not with your target, Deck. We have to trust at our level as well. And with him dealing personally with Hyder, he needs to be informed.
You sure that trust at your level is working?
Kurt saw his face grow dark and held up his hands in surrender.
Okay, okay, sir.
Just tell him we'll only explore. We won't do any Omega operation until after the peace talks. But it's our best chance to bring in Guy. If the Council says no, I still have that problem.
Palmer said, And? You have all the authority you need for that right now. The Council has already voted, and he needs to be stopped, permanently.
Kurt leaned forward and said, We here in D.C. use words like stop him and permanently, without spelling out what that means.
Stopping him may include DOA approval. It may mean pulling the trigger from a distance. And I don't have the authority to order that. Shit, I'm not even sure I have the courage to order that. And I don't know if any team I own will execute.
Alexander Palmer seemed shocked at having it spelled out.
Kurt continued. Guy told Pike that if he saw him again, he'd start shooting first in self-defense. And Pike believes him. I want the Council to make that call. I want them to think about it. I want them to understand what happens based on their words.
President Warren said, You expect them to say no? Kurt turned away from Palmer and looked squarely at the President of the United States.
I want them to understand that if they say no to an Alpha mission, they are ordering the execution of a United States soldier. And it's not just the man who pulls the trigger who has blood on his hands. He stood and said, We all do.
Chapter 50. I lay in bed staring at the wall, blessed sleep hiding just beyond my reach. I'd made the call not to attempt to follow Guy, and we'd left the ferry moving straight to a hotel. Since we'd all been awake for close to 2 days, I'd ordered the team to rack out, then had reported in to Kurt. It had not been a good conversation. After finishing, I'd closed the computer, then simply stared at Jennifer's slumbering form, reflecting where I'd gone wrong, wondering what I was going to have to do to accomplish the mission. I wanted to wake her and talk, but we needed the rest. I thought about going to Knuckles' room, and discarded that as well. The biggest impact on crisis decision-making was lack of sleep, and I'd seen the effects when lives mattered. I'd crawled into bed beside her and closed my eyes, waiting on the sleep to come. It would not. Guy's words on the ferry were eating at me, forcing me to choose between my duty to the task force and my own past. After some uncomfortable back and forth, with Kurt alluding to what I might be asked to do, he'd said he would bring my information higher, asking for permission to go after Guy's target, and in so doing, hopefully rein in his thirst for blood. But I understood the implications if they failed to act. I was going to be ordered to take out Guy. Take out. Right. Euphemisms abounded in our world. Eliminate the threat, reduce the risk, execute kinetic options, clear the target, limit collateral damage. Take out Guy. Like I was removing the trash. All of the words were tidy, clinical descriptions of what in reality was anything but. They involved killing, pure and simple. And I wasn't sure I could do that. I stared at the wall, then felt Jennifer roll over, her leg rubbing against mine. It reminded me of where I was in my life, and that following through on an order to remove Guy may destroy everything I'd worked so hard to build. Guy's words rang true to me, touching a core that I didn't want to reflect on. Did I use the power of the Oversight Council approval as absolution for the deaths I caused? When I'd ignored them in Istanbul, was I right? Or a murderer like Guy? I'd done some seriously bad things in the name of protecting others, but it had always been for what was right. Hadn't it? I wasn't a particularly religious man, but I believed in a higher being. I believed that if I did what was just, I'd be measured on it in the end, the scales of my actions deciding my fate. Had I died a few years ago, when I was in the abyss like Guy, I'd have been found wanting. But now, I was back in the land of the living, doing what was right and protecting those who couldn't protect themselves. And this mission could alter the balance, could alter me. I'd been where Guy was, and I'd learned in Istanbul, once you touched the abyss, it was always a part of you, waiting to take over. Out of nowhere, Jennifer's voice split the quiet, startling me. Pike, you awake? I rolled over, saying, yeah, I am. She pulled her hair out of her eyes, and I saw they were red. She hadn't slept either. I said, Jen, you need to get some rest. We have a pretty bad mission coming up, and for some reason, Guy has a connection to you. I need you 100%. She said, that's what I want to talk about. She started to speak again, then thought better of it. I said, what? I can't do it. I can't use his emotions to kill him. I won't. She bored into me for a moment, then said, and I don't want you to either. This is bad. Evil. There is no goodness in any of this. It's bad what he's doing, and it's bad what we're planning. It's evil all the way around. I feel like I'm swimming in raw sewage. That caused a grin to slip out. Swimming in raw sewage. Eloquent. She took my hand and said, I'm serious. I saw you with Guy. I saw what his statements were doing to you, and that was just a talk. You go through with this and it'll be permanent to all of us. I flopped on my back and said, he's not like me. He's not. She said, he's just like you. Nobody but me saw you at your rock bottom. He is you. And like you, he doesn't deserve to die. This is bigger than him. I don't want to lose what we have. I propped up on an elbow and said, what's that mean? She looked at me for a moment, then said, in Rome you worked magic. There might be a total of 3 men on Earth who could have done what you did with this team. Maybe even fewer. The task force is pure, it's real, it's concrete, but it's only as good as the men in it. I came into the task force because you asked, but I stayed because of the good we do. It's about saving lives. We execute this mission, and it's going to be about death. I can't do that. I was taken aback at the words. I had pushed her reluctantly into the task force because I saw an innate skill, and she'd fought it the whole way, only staying because I asked, or so I thought. It was the first time she'd ever talked about the mission in the absence of our relationship. She said, "You are the task force." I lay back down thinking about the mission and my place in it, thinking about the growing decision I'd have to make. I heard a knock on the door. Jesus, don't the maids read the do not disturb sign? I thought. I glanced at Jennifer. She shrugged. I padded to the front barefoot, looked out the peephole and saw Nick. Shit, I thought. I thought about ordering Jennifer back to her connecting room, but just didn't have the energy. I opened the door. He said, hey, can we talk for a minute? You need to get some sleep. I want you on your toes. We can talk in 4 hours. No, we can't. I can't sleep. I swung the door wide and he entered. He did a double take on Jennifer in the bed, wearing nothing but an oversized t-shirt. I said, yeah, it's Jennifer. Fucking get over it. What's on your mind? He went from her to me, saying nothing. I said, spit it out. You're cutting into my sleep. Is the internet not working in your room? Hesitantly, he said, I want to talk about the mission, about Guy. I'm not sure I can do this. I started to respond when someone else knocked on the door. I held up a finger and went back to the peephole, seeing Brett. What the hell, I thought. I opened the door and said, what is it about you guys not wanting to sleep? His face was as serious as I'd ever seen it. Usually jovial, with an easy vibe, he was all business. He said, I need to talk to you about what happened on the ferry. I rolled my eyes and said, come on in. Chapter 51. Brett entered, saw Nick, then Jennifer in the bed, and his laid-back attitude finally surfaced. He said, well, well, not what I expected. A threesome with the vice president's son? Nick blushed furiously, saying nothing. Jennifer threw a pillow at his head, but he blocked it. I said, come on, people, I need some damn sleep. What do you want? Brett turned serious again and said, I've seen some shitty things happen in my time. I've been involved in some shitty things. Bad guys we manipulated. Good guys we abandoned when the political wind shifted. People whose motivations we didn't even understand, just using them when we could. But we never did anything like this. Brett had been a recon Marine before joining the Special Activities Division of the CIA as a paramilitary case officer. He'd been involved in more dirty operations than even me. He continued, this mission is the worst of the worst. We need to take a look at what we're being ordered to do, reflect on it. My phone vibrated. I tapped the screen, seeing a text from Knuckles. You awake, it said. I held my finger up to Brett and texted back. Yeah. Can I come down? We need to talk. He texted. I rolled my eyes and texted back. Come on down. Brett said, who's that? Then we heard a knock on the door. He texted from the hallway. I opened it, and Knuckles said, Jennifer here? Yeah. We need to talk about this mission, and I want to do it one-on-one. I stepped aside and held my arm out, saying, we're beyond that now. Come on in. He entered looking confused for a minute at the entire team assembled in my room, wondering what was going on and whether he was being left out. But he knew better than that. He opened his mouth and I said, they all arrived in the last 2 minutes, all wanting to talk about the mission, about Guy. Knuckles nodded and said, good, good, that's exactly why I'm here. I said, and? And by the fact that everyone came here on their own, I don't think I need to say a word. But I will. This mission is shit. He was right, but I was still the team leader with a team leader's responsibility. I said, it may be. Cancel that, it is shit. But I can't pick what we do. We don't always get the James Bond mission in the Cayman Islands, Knuckles, you know that. Then Knuckles used my own sounding board against me. He looked at Jennifer, sitting in the bed with her back against the headboard and the covers pulled up high. You good with this? If he'd have asked Nick, he'd have gotten a wishy-washy response. The new man caught between his loyalty to the chain of command and the mission. Even Brett wouldn't outright confront me in front of the team. But Knuckles knew Jennifer, knew exactly why I connected with her. She had a moral compass that didn't care about the chain of command. She said, no, I'm not. Nobody in this room is good with this. I'm not good with Guy killing, and I'm not good with us killing him to stop him killing. It's disgusting. She paused, catching my eye, and we were the only two people in the room. She said, Pike's not good with this either. Everyone focused on me, and I felt the pressure of disobeying an order I hadn't even received yet. But I'd disobeyed orders before, in Istanbul. Only this time, I wouldn't be doing it to kill. I'd be doing it to save a life, like Jennifer had done with me. I said, everyone, listen to me. You don't follow the orders we're given, and you're done in the task force. They will replace you with someone who will. They've done it to me before. I looked at Nick, the newest member. He nodded, not backing down, comfortable with the choice. I continued, but nobody argues with success. I've seen that firsthand. You could ignore an order if it makes everyone else look good in the end. I went eye to eye with the team, ending with Jennifer. I said, I'm not killing Guy just because the task force says so. He's coming home. I looked at Knuckles. You want to solve this problem the right way? He nodded, a slow smile spreading on his face. He said, yeah, no matter what the council says. I said, okay then. Since all you geniuses want to keep me from sleep, how do we do that? We're all burned for surveillance, and he'll start shooting the moment he sees us. Where do we stand with task force assets? He's ditched his phone. Not surprising, since it's the first thing any one of us would do. The task force has cut off his credit cards and frozen his bank accounts under the name Sean Parnell. But we don't know how much cash he has. With the bank problems in Greece, he probably came over here with a sizable amount, which I guess is saying we don't have a hell of a lot to track with. It was a mistake to confront him on the ferry. Brett said, aw, that's bullshit. Don't second guess that. We were always only getting one shot at a meeting, and it was the perfect spot for the endgame you envisioned. Didn't work out. What else we got? Kurt's taking my report to the Oversight Council. If we are sanctioned for Alpha against the guy on the ferry, we'll get complete task force assets for tracking, and that also might be the leverage we need to bring him in. Nick said, but he's the only one who knows who the man is, a catch-22. We can't even identify the target without Guy pointing the way. That's exactly what I mean. That's what I'll tell Guy. We have Alpha to explore, but we need his intelligence. We need him on the team, not fighting the team. Knuckles said, you think he'll buy that? Best I can do. Nick said, doesn't fix the primary problem. We don't know where Guy is or how to get in touch with him. Brett said, yeah, we don't have a handle, but it wouldn't be the first time. Something will break. You work with Pike long enough, and something always does. Nick looked skeptical, but was afraid to say anything as the junior member of the team. Brett laughed at his expression and said, trust me, it'll happen. Him sleeping with Jennifer is some kind of magic. Jennifer scowled, still under the covers, and Brett said, hey, babe, you got to contribute somehow. I grinned at the ribbing and said, okay, enough. What we need right now is rest. We can't do anything until the Oversight Council meets anyway. Everyone, head back to your rooms. No sooner were the words out of my mouth than I felt my phone vibrate with a text. It was from Carly, and it was succinct. Guy just called me. We need to meet, it said. Knuckles saw my face and said, what is it? I passed him the phone. We aren't getting any sleep. Brett looked at the text, then at Jennifer, eyes opened in mock amazement. He said, you've been busy. This time the pillow found its mark.
Chapter 52. Guy felt the cold seep into the car, the cooling engine ticking its drum of surrender to the outside air. Shoehorned between two cars on the frontage road next to Andrea Segru Street, he watched the front entrance to a four-story building, the bold sign outside proclaiming, The Cotton Club Sex Theater. He was farther away than he wanted, with eight lanes of traffic complete with medians separating him from his target. But the alternative was to park on the eastern frontage road right next to the target and risk being seen. He was forced to use optics, but he felt more secure. He'd been in position for 2 hours and had seen little in the way of movement in or out of the building. But that was to be expected. The disco didn't even open for 5 more hours, remaining still until the darkness came, like a brood of vampires waiting to wake. But sooner or later, Nikos would show. Carly's information had been vague, but he was sure it was accurate. They were too close personally for her to play any silly spy games. She would have just told him no outright. She'd given him the bare minimum of what he wanted, clearly trying to help. But there was something about the call that was off, and he wondered if she was growing suspicious. She'd seemed distant during the conversation, hesitant. He'd asked what was wrong, and she'd proclaimed work, then said she couldn't talk about it. At one point, he thought she was about to ask a question, then she'd backed off. It troubled him, but he knew she would never turn him in, both because of their friendship and because she didn't even know who to report him to. The CIA was absolutely out of the question, and she didn't know how to contact the task force. But Pike did, and that man was devious. In addition, he had Knuckles as his 21C. Knuckles had been as close to Decoy as Guy. He was the man who'd recruited Decoy to the task force in the first place, and had been the man who provided the notification of Decoy's death to Carly. She knew him as well as she did Decoy, which was to say as well as she knew Guy. There was a chance they'd find her here and question her. He doubted she would proactively turn him in, but Pike was a different matter. Guy had heard the stories and seen the results. If there were a weak link, for which Carly qualified, Pike would find it. He was somewhat supernatural in that respect, but even if he did, it no longer mattered. The end game was approaching rapidly, much quicker than Pike could decipher, even with his skills. Guy would kill the final two men soon, and it did no good to try to determine who was on whose side. Pike, Carly, the task force, Billings, Nikos. None of that mattered anymore. For him, there was only one side now. His. After leaving the ferry, Guy had disappeared into the crowds around the dock, moving swiftly to escape whatever net the task force might have attempted. He'd considered throwing his phone into the back of the first passing bongo truck, leaving it on and transmitting, but then thought better of it, settling for breaking it into pieces. After moving steadily north for 30 minutes, losing himself in the concrete and cinder blocks, he'd caught a cab and asked for a cheap hotel. The man who dropped him off at a seedy establishment crammed on a side street between a butcher shop and an auto repair garage, with only 8 rooms and a sign that proclaimed nothing more than hotel. He thought it would work. He checked in using cash, leaving him about $1,000 in euros. He tipped the wizened man behind the counter 50 euros to forego the passport requirement. The clerk had balked, thinking he was an illegal alien or smuggler, until Guy allowed him to inspect his U.S. passport. Guy proclaimed he was afraid of identity theft, and the man believed him. Or more precisely, with the troubles in the Greek economy, he believed the 50 euros. After checking in, he'd set about replacing his phone, attempting to find an ATM that would dispense money from his credit card. His was declined. Initially, he thought it was just a function of the Greek economy, as all ATMs had a limit on the amount a local could withdraw, and thought maybe this bank was saving that limit for Greek citizens, refusing to deliver because his credit card was based in the United States. He'd tried 2 more ATMs with the same results. He'd found a cell phone provider and attempted to purchase a phone directly, using the card under the name Sean Parnell, not something he wanted to do because of the linkages, and the card was declined. So they'd frozen his bank accounts and credit cards. The task force was on the move, just as Pike had said they would be. No matter. He knew their rhythms, knew how they operated, and it was way, way too slow to interdict him. He reverted to his limited cash supply, buying 2 $500 pay-as-you-go credit cards. By midday, he'd burned through most of one with a new cell phone and a rental car, and figured the second would last long enough. All he needed was a max of 2 days to complete the mission. He saw a knot of men approaching the front door to the Cotton Club and raised his small binoculars. A scrum of guys in black leather and denim, all sporting thick beards. One of the men resembled a face on the target package, but he was too far away for Guy to be sure. He saw a preening man in the center, wearing a goatee and a flaming red suede jacket. Nikos, first target in Athens. Chapter 53. Guy still had his mission to take out the final two from the target deck, but couldn't accomplish it with Nikos on the loose. The man had too many connections, too many ways to counter him. He needed the targets from Cotter separated from any help. It was the primary reason he'd chosen Greece instead of Cotter to begin with. He'd debated and finally decided Nikos had to go. It was a complication, but a necessary one. Guy told himself it was based purely on the mission. But the blackness sliding through him, like ropes greased in a charnel house, told him differently. That asshole had picked the fight, chosen his fate. Guy counted the men. 5 total, including Nikos. Probably 2 or 3 hired security, with the remaining being friends or ass-kissers begging for Nikos's attention. 1 held the door, and they all entered. Guy gave them 5 minutes. From a distant memory, he saw his brother over a board game, tired and cranky, saying, "Give me the dice. I'm going on a suicide run." Guy started the car and headed to the small underground tunnel that would allow him to cross the broad thoroughfare, thinking of the past with his brother, actually smelling the cans of Schlitz beer they'd pilfered from their father's fridge on those days long ago. 2 years apart, they'd had a space of time in high school where they'd become infatuated with the game called Risk, a contest of strategy. It involved using armies and dice to attempt to take over the world. The games themselves could last days, but only if his brother retained interest. Guy would play his heart out to the bitter end, no matter if he was losing or not, going on until his plastic armies breathed their final breath. His brother, on the other hand, would get dispirited and quit if he felt he was on the losing end with no recovery. When he became tired of the fight, he'd simply look up and say, "Suicide run," then put all of his plastic tokens on a single country, rolling the dice and attacking each enemy country with the full force of his men, risking all of them until he either won or was demolished. It used to aggravate the hell out of Guy, because 1 out of 10 times the tactic worked, all based on the chance of the roll of the dice, like doubling a bet on every spin of a roulette wheel. No skill, no thought, no strategy. Just brute force and luck. And now, he was going to do the same. He parked on the backside of the building, driving the car up over the curb on its 2 right wheels and blocking the ability for the other cars to leave. He didn't care. Odds were he wasn't walking out alive anyway. He circled the block, playing his brother's Pandora list, feeling the pain, drawing energy from the anger. He walked up to the door of the Cotton Club, passing by windows that were blacked out, hiding what was inside. He tried the aluminum door handle, pulling it an inch and finding it open. He paused for a brief moment, removing his earbuds and adjusting the long barrel of the 6P9 under his left shoulder, getting it ready in the makeshift holster he'd built. He took 2 deep breaths, controlling the anger and channeling the adrenaline. This is it. 5 men. Only 5. He knew that was most likely wrong, but also that he held the edge. The men inside the building understood violence, but only on their terms. They had no idea of the pain he could bring, the skill he held. He opened the door and went inside, letting his eyes adjust to the gloom. The interior was dank and smelled of spilled beer and mildew, the tables looking chipped and dilapidated in the harsh light of the sun, before the night settled in and the vampires began to roam. To his front was a stage, the center portion spearing out between the tables, the length interspersed with floor-to-ceiling poles. On each side was a bar, the one on the left dark and empty, the one on the right lit by small overhead bulbs. He saw a man talking to two women, the man dressed like the usual pipe swinger, leather jacket, cropped beard, and scarred, meaty hands. The women were dressed as if they were going to a costume party, one as a flapper from the 1920s, the other like an Egyptian pharaoh's concubine. Neither was particularly attractive. All three were staring at him from the light he'd caused to explode by opening the door. He turned to them, feeling the weight of his pistol. The women looked hesitant. The man looked aggravated. Guy said, "Hey, I'm here to see Nikos. Is he around?" The man glowered and in broken English said, "No. Nobody here by that name." Guy turned to the girls and repeated the question. They became surly with one in much better English, saying, "Never heard of him. Maybe he'll show when we open." Guy nodded almost robotically, thinking of the size of the building, thinking of how long it would take to clear without information. The man said, "You go." Guy said, "Unfortunately, no. I saw him enter. Either call him or send me up. I'm not leaving." The girls laughed, the one closest to him leaning over, showing her cleavage and saying, "You going to leave? Trust me." The man reached beneath the bar and pulled out a fishing priest with a head encased in a sheath of metal, just like the one used on Guy days before. He said, "Get out now, or pay." In one fluid motion, Guy withdrew his pistol. He placed the long suppressor against the man's forehead and pulled the trigger, spraying the back of the bar, the bullet a muted spit. The man dropped straight down, folding like a slinky with the wires bent. He turned to the girls, the barrel held in the air. He said, Do I need to repeat the question?" In her speech, talking over each other, hanging together as if that would prick them. They told her to find Nico's office. He said, "Lay your phones on the bar." They said so, and he said, "Get the fuck out here, now. The 20 lapper said, "You going to die. You can't come in here and do this. You going to die." Mild, a twisted, crazy thing, saying nothing. They fled, spilling the light in again. He let the door close before he moved, cloaking himself in the blessed darkness again. Suicide run. Chapter 54. Nico said, "By herself or with an escort?" He listened, then disconnected from the call. He saw the Arab tense at his words and mentally sized him up. He recognized that Khalid wasn't the same milquetoast as Haider. The man had steel in him, and might actually have the skill to back up the attitude. He glanced at the two men on either side of the door, giving them an unseen signal. They both withdrew pistols, keeping them between their folded hands in the front, only the barrel poking out. Khalid said, "Is it like we thought? She's going to a meeting?" Nico said, "Haider was my employer. I don't answer to you." Khalid said, "I speak for Haider, and I heard the call. You answer to our money, and we have offered a significant amount for the death of the American. You still owe us for that." Nikos leaned back in his chair, an ostentatious bit of leather designed to showcase the man. Present him as a king on a throne responsible for the fate of anyone brought in his presence. The desk in front of him was much larger than necessary, a burnished solid oak behemoth, and littered with small signals of intimidation, little indicators of his ability to kill, a replica guillotine, a paperweight shaped like a skull, and a letter opener in the form of a miniature Japanese katana. The centerpiece was two M67 fragmentation grenades, both with a rubber band on the spoon, indicating the pin had been pulled, showing that he lived without fear. Nikos picked up the letter opener and played with the edge of the blade, saying, "You've paid me nothing. I attempted in Crete, and yes, I failed, but it cost you nothing. It cost me a great deal, a lot of cleanup. I'm not sure I want to continue with the same agreement here in Athens, especially when it involves a spy from the CIA. It's not good for business. Besides, he's probably still on Crete. I have men looking. He's not on Crete. You don't believe it, and neither do I. Yes, you attempted to catch him. And how long do you think it'll take for him to decipher who is responsible for that failure? You are now on his list, just like we are. He's coming here, and you should be afraid." Nico scoffed, saying, "He's but one man. He can do nothing to me." "Then why did you place surveillance on the U.S. Embassy? Why did you just receive a call telling you that the American's contact was leaving by herself?"
"I keep tabs on her because of my business, nothing more. I need to ensure she's not causing an inadvertent problem. We both have equities. I provide her information, and she provides me leeway to operate. I aggravate her, and she could provide the same information to my government. It's a significant risk to my business, you must understand. I scratch her back, and she scratches mine."
Nico saw the anger flash, Khalid leaning over the desk. "She set up my man. She set you up. She is the catalyst for the American interdicting our meetings. He's here, and she's going to meet him right now." The last two words were punctuated with a stab of a finger into the desk. The men at the back of the room released their hands, freeing the pistols. Nikos waved, telling them to back down. Khalid saw the action and turned, eyeing the men. He said, "You think your security can help you? Haider lives in a world of giving, where money gets what he wants." He turned back to Nikos and said, "I live in the world of taking. You will find this American. You do, and you get the money. More than enough to live out the rest of your days with whores and wine. You don't, and you get me, if the American doesn't find you first." Nikos was a bit unnerved at Khalid's complete lack of fear of the two men at the door, but he still owned the room. He chuckled, playing down the threat. He said, "Okay, okay, Khalid. I see you are afraid of him, but I am not. Here's the deal. You want me to commit to the woman, and it'll double the price. The American was tied to the United States somehow, but the woman is CIA. I know this for a fact. She is our only link to the killer. I need to interrogate her. And is this from Haider? Don't worry about him. As I said, I speak for him. Maybe I should call him first.
Maybe you should get some men moving toward the woman."
Nico showed anger for the first time, saying,
"I can't snatch her off of the street. This is in Qatar, where you can run over whoever you want if you're a citizen. We have laws here."
"She's not working on CIA business. This man we're after is rogue. She's trying to contain it. Anything that happens to her can be blamed on him."
"How do you know this? Where is your information coming from?"
"From the highest levels of the United States government. It's valid, and so is our money."
The phone rang again, and Nikos answered. He listened for a moment, then said,
"No, don't follow her inside. Get the men ready."
He hung up, saying nothing. Thinking. Khalid said,
"Well, Nichols toyed with the letter opener for a moment, then said,
I want half up front. If I move on her, I want the money right now. And I won't do anything else. The woman is my final operation. If it goes bad, I leave, taking your money with me. Non-negotiable.
What's she doing?
She's acting strange. You may be right.
Khalid smiled, and the sight was unsettling, reminding Nikos of a cat toying with a mouse long after the creature was dead. Khalid dialed his phone and spoke in Arabic for a moment. He hung up and said, The money is transferred to the account you gave. Nikos nodded, realizing he was crossing a void from which there was no return. He picked up his own phone and spoke a few words. He placed the handset slowly on the desk and said,
Okay, it's done. She will be brought to a warehouse. I'll turn her over to you, and we are through. You find the American on your own after that.
Khalid said, I go with your men, and that's non-negotiable.
Chapter 55. After giving everyone 30 minutes, we met in the lobby of the Hilton Hotel. I handed out bumper locations for the counter-surveillance effort and gave them a chance to look and ask questions. There were none. Initially, I was just going to take myself and Jennifer, but Brett and Knuckles were having none of that. And then Nick decided that he had enough balls to tell me he wanted to go as well. I thought about ordering them to stand down, but I knew they wouldn't get any sleep until we returned anyway, and I wasn't worried about Carly compromising anything. If she were going to do that, it would have already happened regardless of whom I brought to the meeting, and she wouldn't have scheduled the meeting in the middle of the National Gardens. She would have brought us inside the embassy, where she could control any outcome. Clearly, she wanted to hide this as much as we did. We exited the hotel in 2-minute increments, moving in singleton and pairs, with Jennifer and I going last. The counter-surveillance effort would take the metro, but we would walk, giving them time to set up. The National Garden was really a park, similar in style to our own famed Central Park, but without the scope. Crisscrossed with footpaths and various attractions, like an aviary and a central lake, Carly had picked a gazebo near the very center. Nick would come in from the west, Brett from the south, and Knuckles would position on the east edge, watching us enter. They'd pick up bumper locations that would allow a 360-degree view of the meet location, keeping eyes on anyone who passed to see if they were interested in what we were doing. Jennifer and I would be the stationary element. Carly would come in last. The texts with her were encrypted, so I had to be circumspect when coordinating the activities. I'd asked her if she were bringing her friend for Knuckles to meet, meaning, was she coming with a security package, and she'd said no. I trusted her to a point and told her that was good, because Knuckles had his own date and I didn't want to see a catfight, meaning I'll have security, but I don't want to end up spiking on some hidden CIA clowns crashing the meeting. She'd send back a smiley face emoticon. I chuckled at the absurdity of planning top-secret meetings in the age of Apple. Honestly, I didn't feel there was any threat from the meeting, but it was good to be prepared, and it gave me a chance to train Nick on our way of operating. Jennifer started walking south, and I followed. We went past the War Museum, then cut west, down a road next to the Presidential Palace. We hit the park right next to a Greek soldier standing guard in what looked like a wooden phone booth. Wearing traditional Greek attire from what appeared to be World War I, his fez made him look a little bit like a Shriner waiting on a miniature motorcycle for a parade. We entered the park and consulted a large map behind glass, like we were just a couple more tourists. We found the gazebo on the map, confirming what our overhead imagery had already told us, then wound our way through the trees and rocks, passing the bird sanctuary and the lake, waiting on a call. Knuckles finally said, Good track. Nobody on you. Moving to the bumper. I nodded at Jennifer and said, Roger all. Blood, Veep, give me an up. East side is clear. Nobody of interest, meat site is clean. Roger. Brett came on saying, Pike, this is Blood. South is good. The area opened up a bit into a clearing, and I saw our gazebo. I tried to spot my team, but couldn't, which is exactly what I wanted. The shelter had four separate tables with bench seats surrounding each. None were occupied. We took a seat, and I put a Texas Longhorn ball cap on my head. I said, in position, and heard, stand by. Carly was coming from the south, so I knew she'd bump into Brett first. It happened 5 minutes later. Pike, this is Blood. Spook is inbound.
Guy heard the door open upstairs, then the pounding of feet coming lower. He vaulted over the bar, landing on the body of the man he'd killed earlier. He crouched in the shadows, weapon ready. He heard a shout in Greek, someone looking for the bartender or the girls. He heard a man approach and flattened against the edge of the bar, sliding as much as he could into the shelving, while keeping his weapon available for instant use. He held his breath, catching shadows against the walls. The man above picked up one of the cell phones of the girls, and Guy cursed himself for not bringing them over the bar when he leapt. The man said something else in Greek, then Guy heard another voice speaking English, with an Arabic accent. I need to leave now. What are we waiting on? The other man said, your car, unless you want to run. The Arab voice said, what do you mean? Are you not coming? A third voice said, no, our driver will take you to the park. We aren't foot soldiers. We stay here with the boss in case you decide you want to return. Guy saw a flash of light against the wall, the outside door opening, then heard more Greek. Finally, one of the men said, go, he will take you to the other man. The light splashed again. Then he heard muttering in Greek, followed by a laugh. He waited and heard two sets of feet going back up the stairs. He remained still for a full 2 minutes, then slid quietly out, climbing over the chipped wooden top. He dropped lightly to the other side, noticing that the two cell phones were gone. He had no idea what had just transpired, but knew he was running out of time. Sooner rather than later, someone else was going to enter the slut shop, and he didn't want to kill anyone who didn't deserve it. He found the stairs, thinking of the noise the men had made coming down them. He went to the rail, spreading his legs until each foot was as close to a support beam as possible, and began waddling up the staircase. He reached the top and paused, looking down the narrow hallway. Illuminated by a single bulb, midway down, most of the hallway was in shadows. According to the woman from below, Nikos's office was the last one on the left side of the hall, adjacent to the only fire escape attached to the building, which made sense, as he'd want a way to flee if raided. The problem was that in order to reach it, he had to pass other rooms, and he didn't want to leave an uncleared area behind him. It was asking to be attacked from the rear. But he had no team with him, and he couldn't possibly assault each room without alerting his primary target. He needed speed and surprise, which he would lose the minute he engaged anyone, whether it was a non-combatant or not. He counted down the hallway, seeing three doors on the left and three on the right. Only two had light spilling out from the threshold. The target's door at the end of the hall, and the one closest to him. Decision time.
Chapter 56. I acknowledged the call from Brett, glancing to the south. I saw a family of four about 100 meters away, then saw Carly wandering through the trees, looking for the safe signal. My ball cap. She saw it, then sauntered over to us. She sat down and raised her eyebrow. I held up a finger, then heard, she's clean, nobody's on her. I said, Roger, all elements stand by. Carly said, so you didn't find my secret agents? I said no, they must be very, very good. She stuck her hand across the table and said, "You must be the infamous Coco. Decoy told me all about you." Jennifer took her hand and said, "Well, clearly not all about me, or you'd know I hate that call sign." Carly's face froze for a moment, like she'd made a faux pas, and Jennifer let her off the hook, saying, "Decoy was a good man, even when he was trying to get my clothes off. I miss him." Carly said, "I do too, believe me, and I don't want to lose Guy the same way." I said, "So what's up with the contact? Did you tell him we'd talked?" "No, no, not at all. I thought about it, but I believe it would have only spooked him. He asked for information." "What information?" "He asked about Nikos. I'd set up a meeting between them initially, but this time he didn't want that. He asked for specifics. Where Nikos worked, how deep his connections ran, what were the limits of his turf, and where he spent most of his time. Basic biodata stuff we keep on all the members of organized crime here in Athens. The same dossier you wanted." "That's not good," I thought. "Did you give it to him?" She slid a piece of paper across the table to Jennifer and said, "I did. And before you said, I know he's not using it for a sanctioned operation. But I had to give him something or he would have become suspicious. I offered a few crumbs. Not nearly as much as you got. So he's going to have to work a bit to develop a pattern of life to use Nikos as a link to whatever else he's doing. I texted you right after." She saw my face and said, "Pike, I had a decision to make. You asked me to help you bring him in, and this was the best way. I get him busy chasing his tail, and you develop actionable intelligence to bring him in." She finished the statement by pointing to the paper in Jennifer's hand. Jennifer held it up, and I saw a complete breakdown of the handset he was currently using. IMSI, IMEI, make, model, where he'd purchased it, how much it cost, and the cellular plan it was tethered to. She'd obviously been using government resources at great risk to herself. Getting such data would be a significant breach, involving more than just the CIA. But it may not be enough. I said, "Carly, someone attempted to capture Guy in Crete. Someone with significant host nation assets and capability, and no restraint about violence. It wasn't the guys from Qatar." She took that in, drawing the lines between the dots and beginning to look nauseous. She said, "Nikos?" "Yes, I think so. Well, I can guarantee that Guy thinks so." She put her head in her hands, saying, "Jesus Christ, every time I help you guys, I end up doing more harm than good." Jennifer put her hand on Carly's shoulder and said, "You didn't know, and we needed this information. You just cut our search time by an order of magnitude. If you hadn't played out your hand, he would have ditched this phone as well." I said, "Did you give him enough to find Nikos? If he wasn't trying to use Nikos as a lead for follow-on operations, if he was using it as an end itself, could he do so?" She deflated like a pet that had been scolded, looking for support from the very person who had punished her. "Yes, he could." I said, "Okay, no biggie. We've still got time. Don't worry about that right now. You made a call, and it was correct. I need everything you gave him." She said, "Pike, if he kills Nikos, it'll rupture some very tightly wound alliances. It'll be a disaster." "I got it. I'm more worried about the guys from Qatar because of international repercussions. A dead mafia guy is the least of my concerns." She didn't look convinced, and I said, "Was Nikos a valuable source for you guys?" She shook her head. "No, he's a shitbag. We can't prove it, but he's into child prostitution, gun running, and false identification to a host of bad folks. We used him more as a hedge to prevent stuff from going down. You know, have a meet, ask some pointed questions in such a manner that he'd back off from certain things. I always got the impression he'd kill me if it suited him. The only reason he didn't was because he knew I was with the U.S. government." "Then quit worrying about him. Worry about Guy. I'm going to need your help to bring him in. He trusts you. Can you take a few days off for personal reasons?" She shook her head, saying, "Bad timing. I have to go to a high-level conference tomorrow with the Secretary of State. He's meeting some schmucks here in Greece one-on-one, and the National Command Authority doesn't think he's capable. I'm hand-holding. That made no sense. I said, they need CIA talent for a state meeting? You don't even speak Greek. She said, yeah, I know. That's not why they want me. It's a backdoor thing involving a contact from another country. I can't really tell you more than that. I'm just not available. I started to reply when Nick came on the radio saying, Pike, this is Veep. I have some activity. Two men coming your way, and they're acting strange. Veep was in the west position. Neither Carly nor I had come from that direction, so they couldn't have pinged on us. It was nothing. But I didn't want to stifle his willingness to report. I said, keep eyes on, almost done. Brett cut in. Pike, this is Blood. I got one coming your way as well, not a tourist, and I got a printing on his clothes. Meaning he could see the outline of a gun. I looked at Jennifer, seeing her begin to slide her own hand down to the hidden Glock in her purse. Carly saw the movement and said, what's going on? You armed? I asked. No, we don't carry in Greece. What's happening? Knuckles came on. Pike, I got two from my side. One of them is an Arab from the target package. He's not here out of coincidence. Someone must have seen Carly enter, but didn't follow. Now they're hunting, beating the bushes. My eyes narrowed at the words. I looked at Jennifer and said, get her out. You're her PSD. Take her to the north, towards the Parliament building. There were no northern exits to the park, but there was a slew of security around the Parliament building. Carly said, what the hell is going on? You're being hunted. They're trying to find Guy, and they're using you to do it. Jennifer stood, putting her hand on Carly's bicep and pulled her to her feet. Carly said, wait, what are you going to do? I pulled my own weapon and said, fight.
Chapter 57. Guy slid to the closest door with light spilling out and gently put his ear to it. He heard a woman and a man talking. At least two. There was a sign in Greek on the door, complete with a silhouette of a nude dancer. A dressing room, hopefully. Each of the offices had a large window looking into the hall, which the club had painted flat black. In places, the paint had chipped away, letting light through and hopefully giving Guy a way to confirm his thoughts. He crouched down and duck-walked beneath the sill, putting an eye to the nearest crack in the paint. He saw a rack of costumes in the edge of a mirror over a desk. Then a woman, completely nude, her hair in curlers. She plucked two tissues from a box and wiped her mouth. Guy heard the man in the room laugh, then watched the woman pull something off the rack. Guy hugged the wall, letting her move back deeper into the dressing room. Clearly, they were focused on each other. But ignoring them left his escape route compromised. He decided to leave them alone, even with the man in the room. If he moved swiftly enough, he could kill everyone in Nikos's office, then exit down the fire escape, if it was there. He moved in a crouch below the window, then stood, his weapon raised. He shuffled forward, sliding his feet to maintain a solid firing stance, his eyes on the final door. He reached the middle of the hallway, directly underneath the anemic incandescent bulb, and heard the door behind him open, the girl chatting with the man inside. He whirled around, the sights of the 6P9 settling instinctively on the woman's nose. She was wearing nothing but a teddy, one curler hanging low, out of place with the rest. He saw her mouth drop into a perfect little O, and time stood still. His brain screamed at him to pull the trigger, to silence her before she could compromise the mission. He could not. She shrieked louder than an actress in a horror movie, then stumbled backward, finding the stairs and racing down them. The man burst out at the noise, a pistol in his hands, sliding right into Guy's sight picture. Guy squeezed twice, the suppressor making a muted spit. The man's head snapped back, and he fell without uttering a sound. Behind him, a door burst open, and the light from Nikos's office invaded the hallway.
Guy heard a man shout. He whirled around, dropping to a knee and firing at the silhouette framed by the illumination. The man did the same, firing where Guy had just been. He felt the crack of rounds splitting the air above him, then saw the man topple over, wounded. The man began crawling backward, pulling himself into the office. Guy fired into the body, stilling the movement. Guy had a choice to make in the span of a millisecond: use the escape route behind him or press the fight. Suicide run. He stood, raced toward the open door, and the black window shattered, an object coming through. Something bounced against the wall and hit the floor. Guy recognized the object instantly and slid to a stop, incredulous. Grenade. He turned and kicked the nearest door beneath its knob, the jamb splintering open. He dove inside just as the grenade went off, feeling shrapnel slam into his legs, the explosion whipping him sideways into the door jamb. He rolled over, the ringing in his ears blocking out everything else. He shook his head, trying to clear the fog. He checked his legs, relieved to see each still attached. His right calf was peppered in blood, looking like someone had repeatedly stabbed a fork into it. He tested it and found it would support his weight. He pulled up to the corner of the door and peeked out, wondering how many grenades Nikos might have, feeling the press of time. He knew speed was of the essence, as the concussion most assuredly would attract the attention of others, either police or more foot soldiers. He saw movement, a man ducking below the shattered window, and slithered out of the room on his belly, high crawling down the hallway, using his elbows and knees. He reached the office doorway and backed into the wall, glancing inside. He saw a massive desk, two chairs to the front, but no man. Underneath the window. He coiled his legs, then leapt through the door sideways. He landed on his left side, his barrel aimed at a man stunned by his appearance. He pulled the trigger twice, watching the bullet slam into the man's head and explode out the back. It wasn't Nikos. Guy rolled over, swinging the weapon in an arc. He found no other threats, but saw the ladder outside the window. Escape. He pulled into a crouch, then leapt on top of the desk, aiming the gun on the other side. Nikos was cowering behind an ostentatious leather chair, his hands out front, trying to ward off the death. He said,
"Don't, don't, don't."
Guy said, "Where can I find the Arabs?"
"I don't know. I just call them and we meet up."
Guy crouched down, picking up the remaining grenade. He tested the rubber band, then put it into his jacket pocket. He said, "Give me your phone."
"It's on the desk."
Guy picked it up, and Nikos gained courage from the fact that he was still alive, mistaking the delay as fear on Guy's part.
"You harm me, and you'll be hunted until the day you die. There is no place you can hide. When my father finds you, he will kill you very, very slowly."
Guy said, "I guess you're a bad man, huh?" Nico sat up, straightening his shirt and running his hand through his hair.
"That's right. I'm not someone to trifle with. Let's talk business. I owe no allegiance to the Arabs."
Guy heard noises down the hall, then footsteps on the stairs. He said, "Are the Arabs still at the Athenium Hotel?" Nikos heard the men coming and stalled, saying,
"I'll take you to them. I'll help you kill them."
Guy raised the barrel and Nikos said,
all right, yes. They're at the Athenium Intercontinental just up the street, okay? Now what?"
Guy cocked his head toward the man on the floor, the blood and brain matter congealing on the wall, reminding him of Nasser in the shower. Reminding him of Nasser calling to him in the night. The deaths he'd caused flashed through his mind, the tendrils of the abyss wrapping him tighter. He said, "I guess I'm a bad man, too." Puzzled, Nico said nothing. Guy raised the barrel and said, "It's not a good day
to be a bad man.
This ends Disc 7.